More Americans were more affluent than ever before in the latter part of the 19th century as the nation recovered from the destruction of the Civil War. Raw materials were being moved from the West, from the South, and elsewhere, to the rapidly expanding industrial centers of the Northeast. In this changing world, American writers began to set themselves a new standard, that of describing life around them as realistically as possible. They prized clarity, order, and economy of words. As writers drew upon their own locales, the South, the West, the Northeast, the literature began to acquire a variety of regional flavors.
Some called it the Gilded Age, borrowed from the title of a Mark Twain book. Twain viewed his world with affection and humor, even when he wrote satirically about social and economic conditions. Born in Missouri in 1835, Twain worked as a steamboat pilot on the Mississippi, a miner, an apprentice printer, and a newspaper reporter. The celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County established his fame as a humorous storyteller. In the story, the gambler Jim Smiley bets that his frog, Dan'l Webster, can outjump any other. He loses his bet when someone feeds the frog pellets to prevent it from jumping.
At last, Smiley says, "I wonder if there ain't something the matter with him. He appears to look mighty baggy somehow." And he catched Dan'l by the nape of the neck and hefted him and says, "Why, blame my cats if he don't weigh 5 pound."
Twain drew upon his boyhood experiences along the Mississippi River for his best-known novels, Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. In Huckleberry Finn, Huck and Jim, a runaway slave, float down the Mississippi on a raft.
"We said there weren't no home like a raft, after all. Other places do seem so cramped up and smothery, but a raft don't. You feel mighty free and easy and comfortable on a raft."
Twain's adventurous yarns displayed his talent for capturing colloquial speech and for attacking social injustice with wit. In Huckleberry Finn, Twain shows how the drive to acquire material possessions can breed hypocrisy and corruption. But Twain weaves in his ideas with such skill that they never distract the reader from the flow of the story. Twain's engaging personality drew large audiences to his lectures. He said that he was not a humorist, that he merely told the truth, and that most people, not being familiar with the truth, found it funny. He described what he saw and heard around him, and was a forerunner of the literary movement called realism. Although he later turned to more somber themes, probing human nature, he is best remembered for his earlier works that so lightheartedly and effectively evoked the flavor of life along the Mississippi. Another author who captured the local color of a particular region was Bret Harte, whose focus was the West. His characters were miners, outlaws, and sentimentalized lovers. In his story, The Luck of Roaring Camp, a child born in a mining camp loses his mother soon after his birth and is raised by the miners. He's named Tommy Luck and called The Luck.
On the long summer days, the Luck was usually carried to the gulch from whence the golden store of Roaring Camp was taken. Generally, someone would bring him a cluster of wild honeysuckle, azaleas, or the painted blossoms of Las Mariposas. The men had suddenly awakened to the fact that there were beauty and significance in these trifles.
Joel Chandler Harris also wrote about a particular region, Georgia. Most of his stories revolve around the black people he knew while working as a youth on a Georgia plantation. Harris created the character Uncle Remus, who entertains a small boy with stories about animals who are given human qualities, Br'er Bear, Br'er Rabbit, and Br'er Fox. These characters are always getting into difficult situations and trying to outwit one another.
"Skin me, Br'er Fox," says Br'er Rabbit, says he. "Snatch out my eyeballs, tar out my ears by the roots, and cut off my legs," says he. "But do please, Br'er Fox, don't fling me in that briar patch," says he.
This picture comes from a Hindu edition of the popular Uncle Remus tales, which were translated into many languages. Sarah Orne Jewett introduced the region around her home in Maine to a wide audience. As a child, Sarah accompanied her father, a doctor, on his rounds. She later said,
"The best of my education was received in my father's buggy and the places to which it carried me."
When Sarah Orne Jewett began writing, many young people were leaving Maine to seek better lives in the cities. The old-timers who remained were deeply attached to their habitat, which had nurtured prosperous sailors, farmers, and shipbuilders. Many of Jewett's stories capture the special independence and courage she found characteristic of the local people. Jewett's rhythmic descriptions of the sea and the woods around it have been compared to music or painting.
"Half a mile from home, at the farther edge of the woods, where the land was highest, a great pine tree stood, the last of its generation. Whether it was left for a boundary mark, no one could say."
Jewett's stories focused on rural life, while her contemporary, George Washington Cable, captured the sparkle of city life in New Orleans. The characters in Cable's stories were usually Creoles, descendants of French and Spanish settlers, often of mixed white and black ancestry. The stories usually dealt with the past, especially the traditions that prevailed before the Civil War. Cable's settings were the Old City, the French Quarter, with its lacy ironwork balconies, and the old plantations. His characters were beautiful young women and dashing heroes. Cable's stories also dealt with some of the harsher aspects of local life, such as the strict caste system based on skin color. Cable teamed up with Mark Twain in a series of lecture tours, during which he too charmed audiences. A younger writer, Stephen Crane, took realism beyond the limits that 19th century publishers could accept. His first novel, Maggie, A Girl of the Streets, tells the story of the daughter of a brutal father and a drunken mother. Maggie is seduced, disowned, and driven to live on the streets of New York. The book's descriptions of the cruelty and degradation of the New York slums was so shocking that Crane could get the novel published only by paying for it himself. The Red Badge of Courage, which dealt with the feelings and fears of soldiers in the Civil War, established Crane's reputation. The book's protagonist, Henry Fleming, is a farm boy whose romantic illusions about war are shattered when he confronts his own fear. Though Crane had no personal experience with war, he succeeded so remarkably in portraying the real inner conflicts experienced by soldiers that the book became a highly acclaimed bestseller. Crane's free verse demonstrates his skill at evoking a striking picture.
"Black riders came from the sea. There was clang and clang of spear and shield, and clash of hoof and heel. Wild shouts and the wave of hair and the rush upon the wind. Thus the ride of sin."
From 1891 until well into the 1900s, William Dean Howells was widely regarded as the most influential among American writers of his time. Howells believed that books should reflect real life. He asked of all fiction,
"Is it true? True to the motives, the impulses, the principles that shape the lives of actual men and women?"
As editor of The Atlantic, and later as columnist for Harper's Magazine, Howells helped to shape the literary tastes of a whole generation in his reviews of the works of Mark Twain, Stephen Crane, Hamlin Garland, Frank Norris, and others. Many of his own novels, especially popular with women readers, were love stories. With all his insistence on realism, he scrupulously observed the conventions of his time by avoiding any reference to sexuality. Howells' best-known work is The Rise of Silas Lapham, the story of a self-made businessman from Vermont who tries to make a place for himself in Boston society. He and his family succeed in adopting the appropriate external appearances. But he is ultimately defeated by his lack of knowledge of the manners of Boston high society. Silas becomes totally disillusioned about business when he discovers that cheating and lying are often used in the struggle to stay at the top. He is ruined financially, but he triumphs spiritually when he decides that success is not worth the price of dishonesty. Silas Lapham embodied Howells' concept of realism, which he carried into his personal life. In 1886, he risked his reputation by publicly supporting the labor leaders sentenced to death after the Chicago Haymarket strike for an 8-hour day. But in his later years, Howells felt rejected.
"I am comparatively a dead cult, with my statues cut down and the grass growing over me in the pale moonlight."
Howells wrote these words to his friend Henry James, another writer who believed strongly in realism. James once said,
"The only reason for the existence of the novel is that it should attempt to represent life."
Born in New York City to wealthy parents, James had a privileged childhood. He was educated by private tutors and traveled throughout Europe in his youth. In 1862, he withdrew from Harvard Law School, where he claimed he understood nothing. His first story was published when he was 21 years old. Believing that Americans were immature and lacked the traditions to nurture great literature, James settled in London. Many of his characters are Americans reacting to the culture and customs of Europe. In Daisy Miller, a charming, naive girl from Schenectady, New York, arrives in Switzerland.
She was dressed in white muslin with 100 frills and flounces and knots of pale-colored ribbon. She balanced in her hand a large parasol, and she was strikingly, admirably pretty.
Frederick Winterbourne, an American expatriate living in Switzerland, is attracted to Daisy. Having lost touch with American ways, however, he misinterprets Daisy's free and flirtatious manner. Only after she dies does he realize she cared for him. In Portrait of a Lady, considered by some his best novel, James tells the story of another charming American.
Isabel Archer spent half her time thinking of beauty and bravery and magnanimity. She had a fixed determination to regard the world as a place of brightness.
Isabel is deceived by her husband, but her sense of duty and her strong pride keep her with him. James tells this story by focusing on the inner thoughts of his characters rather than on their actions, a literary technique that was revolutionary in 1881. James used another innovative technique, telling a story through the eyes of a character who is not directly involved. What Maisie knew is partially told by a 12-year-old girl who observes the infidelities of her parents and step-parents. While James's characters usually stayed faithful to their finer instincts, Frank Norris created characters who became victims of their baser passions, such as greed or violence. In much of Norris's work, the men and women are depicted as unable to change the profound effects of their heredity and environment. This was a new trend in realistic literature called naturalism. In McTeague, Norris depicts a character who cannot control his animalistic nature.
The brute that in McTeague lay so close to the surface leaped instantly to life, monstrous, not to be resisted. He sprang to his feet with a shrill and meaningless clamor, the hideous yelling of a hurt beast.
In The Octopus, the first book in his trilogy about the growth, sale, and consumption of wheat in the United States, Norris describes a war between the ranchers in the San Joaquin Valley and a corrupt railway enterprise. The wheat comes to symbolize a life force threatened by a machine, the railroad.
There it was, the wheat, the wheat. In the night it had come up. It was there everywhere from margin to margin of the horizon.
His second book in the trilogy, The Pit, exposes the avaricious world of the Chicago Wheat Exchange in a negative comment on American capitalism. Summing up his literary philosophy, Norris said,
"I never truckled. I never took off the hat to fashion and held it out for pennies. By God, I told them the truth."
Jack London, like Norris, believed that men were sometimes motivated by primitive and violent instincts. Some of his best-known novels present man and beast struggling against the unpredictable, sometimes brutal forces of nature. In The Call of the Wild, a dog called Buck is stolen from a California estate and shipped to the Klondike, where he is trained as a sledge dog. Buck breaks loose and becomes the leader of a wolf pack when his beloved master is murdered by Indians. London's attitude toward death reflected the naturalist view that destiny is controlled by impersonal, social, economic, and biological forces.
It was the same everywhere, with all things. The mosquitoes vanished with the first frost. The little tree squirrel crawled away to die. Even the big bald face grew clumsy and blind and quarrelsome. In the end, to be dragged down by a handful of yelping huskies.
In the early 20th century, writers would be as affected as everyone else by a new dramatic change, a world made immeasurably more tightly knit by the impact of the automobile, the telephone, and the airplane.